You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
And now here's Rod Adams and Shane Brown with The Atomic Show.
It's atomic. It's atomic.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 48. And with me tonight is Dr. J. Marvin Herndon, who is a geophysicist. Is that correct, sir?
Usually I'm referred to as a geophysicist, although I'm trained both in chemistry and in physics. So I cross a lot of borders there. But people usually think of me as a geophysicist.
That's
certainly a good characterization.
Well, that's good. And Dr. Herndon has been researching the makeup of the Earth for, at least, I've dated your research at least the last 20 years, probably longer than that.
Let's go back about 30 years.
Okay, I missed a few years, I guess.
I'd like to hack off a few years, but it doesn't work that way.
Well, I know the feeling because I'm going on close to 30 years of professional life myself, so time marches on.
Well, would it help if I gave you sort of a quick summary of this 30 years?
Sure, that'd be great.
Well, I was really quite fortunate when I finished graduate school and with a PhD in nuclear chemistry from Texas A&M in 74. I quite unexpectedly fell into an incredible opportunity. As an undergraduate, I had graduated from the University of California at San Diego with a bachelor's degree in physics before going to graduate school. And I came back out to California after graduate school, and I went to the UCSD campus to, I guess, the library or something. Ran into a professor that I knew, and he invited me to give a seminar, and that sounded good. So in a couple of months, we had set up a time, and I gave a seminar, and it was technically a cosmochemistry seminar, and it was just your typical mix of some professors, some graduate students, everyone pretty much casually attired as they would in about 1974.
Yeah, all those academic types probably had patches on the sleeves of your shirts and stuff.
Yeah, very, very laid-back group. But there was this one gentleman in the audience, snowy-haired, blue suit, maroon tie, very conservative. And I recognized him right off the bat. That was Harold Urey, who you may recall was a recipient of the Nobel Prize in 1934, and who, as a young PhD, was able to study with Niels Bohr. There was another chap in the audience, someone I had never seen before, but whom I recognized immediately from what I was told. My thesis advisor had told me that this man looked like a teddy bear, and his eyes twinkled. And this was Hans Suess. And sure enough, after the seminar, he came up and introduced himself. And, you know, it was a typical seminar. I gave a seminar, I answered questions. Then Suess came up, and I met him. And he invited me to stop by his office the next day. Well, this was, I'd be happy to, but I thought about this all night, and I worried, well, did I say something wrong? I mean, you know, this is a real famous guy. I mean, he was a co-discoverer of the shell structure of the atomic nucleus, which won his colleague, Hans Jensen, a share of the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
Seuss had developed the radiocarbon dating technique. He had published one of the first, if not the first, papers warning of the danger of global warming from the combustion of fossil fuels.
Wow. When was that?
That was a 1957 paper with Roger Revelle.
Hmm.
And so, I mean, you know, this guy was quite knowledgeable, so I was a little bit worried. Well, I visited him in his office, and he talked about a lot of things and told me a lot about his history and what he was doing. And then never mentioned the seminar. But then suddenly he stopped talking, and he looked straight at me and invited me to become a postdoctoral scholar, to learn from him and from Harold Urey, and to do for 3 years whatever science I wanted to do.
What an opportunity.
What an opportunity. Now, at the time, I had support. I wasn't looking for support when I gave that seminar, but I certainly had no idea when I walked into his office what he was about to say. But, you know, I was speechless. Well, not quite speechless. I was controlled enough to say, yes, yes, thank you much. And so that started a something that was a very, very unusual thing. Both Urey and Seuss were at a reasonably advanced age. And Hans Seuss had learned from his father, who was a famous geochemist, Fritz Seuss, who had learned from his father, Edward Seuss, which was another famous, even more famous geochemist, who was, you know, a correspondent of Charles Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the opportunity to learn from these gentlemen, and I took advantage of it, and I learned a lot of things that most people never get exposed to.
Because these guys hadn't taken time to write it all down, or?
Well, a lot of things you learn that aren't things that are taught, and I'm not talking about the details of a particular subject. I'm talking about what's important in science and how to proceed in science, and how to make discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, little fragments and bits and pieces that you learn from people like this. So I learned very well, and it was an interesting. I could talk for hours about the experience, because I discovered very early on that I, even though I was well trained and thought I could read well and write well, I could do neither of those. And I learned a whole different way of approaching things. But so that was my background, and shortly after I finished this. I was on the staff as a researcher, supported by grant monies, at the University of California, when I realized that the inner core of the Earth was not what people thought. Now, if we spring back, and the core of the Earth was discovered in 1906.
Okay.
And soon thereafter, it was found to be liquid. And in 1936. A lady seismologist, a rather attractive young lady from Denmark named Inga Lehmann, discovered a solid object at the center of that core, and that's the inner core, which is an object slightly smaller than the moon and about three times as massive. And so by 1940, people like Francis Birch at Harvard thought they had figured out what it was made of.
And what was the theory then?
Well, the idea was that the inside of the Earth was like one of the common chondrites, meteorites that fall to Earth. And if you were to melt one, you'd find that the iron and iron sulfide would alloy together and would settle by gravity, and there'd be rock on top of it. And so they thought that the Earth was like that, and for good reason. Well, in meteorites, nickel and iron are virtually always alloyed. And if you take all of the elements heavier than nickel, they won't add up to make a mass as big as the inner core. So what Francis Birch thought was that the inner core is nickel iron metal that's just starting to crystallize from the melt. Well, that idea is what you learn in school books. It became part of the litany of the inside of the planet. Well, along about the 1970s, late 1970s, I was looking at other types of meteorites that were similar to the Earth that Francis Birch had ignored, very rare ones. And I realized that some discoveries had been made in the 1960s that opened up a different possibility. And in one group of meteorites called instatite chondrites that formed under conditions where oxygen was much more limited, so limited that some of the elements that normally like to combine with oxygen didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You had silicon in the metal, and a compound of nickel and silicon was observed. And what this said to me was, in that kind of material, the presence of silicon could cause nickel to precipitate, to fall out of solution, and based on the abundance of nickel, that would make a mass just right to be the inner core mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so I published that. I published that in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London. And I thought, well, gee, you know, now people will, there'll be a lot of discussion and debate, and people will do experiments. I got a very, very nice complimentary letter from Inga Lehmann, the lady who had discovered the inner core.
Mm-hmm.
But then silence. Silence. The geoscience community pretended that never was published. And pretty soon my support dried up, and without support I was out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on to something that was too important to let go. And to make a long story short, I progressed onward, and I found that the inside of the Earth is indeed like one of those so-called instatite chondrites, one of those other kinds of meteorites, not like the ordinary chondrite that Francis Birch thought.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the low abundance of oxygen, the low availability of oxygen when that kind of material formed, some of the elements that normally would be with oxygen and other meteorites were not, and they ended up in the core. And one of those is uranium. And this became very important later on, although I really didn't appreciate it to the full extent at the time.
How much uranium do you think? What kind of concentrations?
Well, you're really talking about concentrations of parts per billion.
Okay.
But if you put that, you know, if you consider the total amount, I mean, you're looking at a ball of uranium that could be, for example, 5 or 8 miles across.
Okay.
In diameter, and we're talking about at a pressure where it's twice as dense as it would be under normal conditions.
And it's pretty dense under normal conditions.
Yeah, well, you just about double it in at the center of the Earth. Well, now, let me take a hop, skip, and a jump backward in time. When I was a graduate student at Texas A&M in 1972, my thesis advisor, Marvin Rowe, came into the lab one time to find me, to tell me about something exciting that he had learned from his thesis advisor, who was Paul K. Kuroda. Kuroda was formerly a young scientist, nuclear scientist in Imperial Japan, and then after the war immigrated to the U.S., became a U.S. citizen. The news that I was being told was that French scientists had discovered the intact remains of a naturally occurring nuclear reactor at Oklo, in the Republic of Gabon in Western Africa. And this was really quite exciting news. But what made it especially important is that in 1956, Paul K. Kuroda had predicted that 2 billion years ago, the concentration of U-235 relative to 238 would be sufficiently great that a seams of uranium that were, say, a meter thick, uranium ore, could undergo self-sustaining chain reactions. And he published that. He told me the story that Kuroda told me later on that the only reason he was able to publish that at the time was because one journal would allow papers that were less than one page long or less to be published without review.
Okay.
It's a very unpopular paper. But then the French came along, 16 years later, I guess, and discovered the actual remains of such reactors that operated very much as Kuroda had predicted.
It's always nice when a prediction based on sound science is proven to be true.
Oh, it is indeed. And I remember thinking at the time, this has got to be hugely important. I mean, this is must have profound significance. But, you know, it was like looking out into a fog. You know, there were too many unknowns to know what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't realize it, but over the next 20 years or so, I was actually filling in those missing pieces unconsciously without realizing it. And so back then it got to be around 1990 or so when one of my sons had gotten a book about the planets and called my attention to Jupiter. Now, I don't know how far you go back, but when I was a student, a schoolboy, we were taught that planets don't really produce energy. They just receive it from the sun and then re-radiate it.
Right.
Well, in the late 60s, astronomers started discovering that Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune each radiate about twice as much energy as they receive from the sun.
Now, the Earth does also, is that correct?
Well, the Earth radiates energy as well, but you can't really tell how much because there's so much solar.
Okay.
We're so close to the sun.
Okay.
But we know the Earth has an energy source deep within it that powers its geomagnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that in a minute. But getting back to the giant planets, the only explanation that people could come up with, they said, well, you know, we've basically looked at all the possibilities. It can't be any of these. Therefore, it has to be energy left over from when the planet formed 4.5 billion years ago. Still being radiated.
But couldn't they integrate and say, well, geez, if it had been radiated for 4.5 billion years, it would have lost X amount of energy?
Well, especially when you realize that Jupiter is 98% hydrogen and helium. And, I mean, you can't get better heat transfer media than that.
Right, right.
So, and that's a risky thing to say, okay, we've looked at everything by default. It has to be, because if you miss something, you get yourself in real trouble. And that's what actually happened. They missed the possibility of nuclear fission. And all of a sudden, as I was thinking about this, actually I was walking through a grocery store, I was shopping with the wife for groceries, and just, you know, all of a sudden it hit me that Jupiter had all the ingredients for a planetary scale nuclear reactor, a nuclear reactor at its center.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked out the physics, and much in the way that Paul Kuroda had predicted the Oklo reactors, and published that in very early in the year in 1992 in Naturwissenschaften, which is the German equivalent of science, nature.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the paper had just come out. When I was thinking about it, I originally was thinking that you had to have hydrogen to have a thermal neutron reactor.
Right, sort of moderator.
Yeah, moderator. And so I worked out the calculations, and it turned out that UH3 is the ideal combination there of fuel and moderator.
Okay.
Well, after it came out, I got to thinking, okay, what would happen if the hydrogen were driven away by the heat? And the answer was obvious. You'd have a fast neutron reactor. Didn't need the hydrogen at all, especially at the time that these things would form, because the ratio of U-235-238 was so great.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you'd have is a fast neutron breeder reactor. And one of the things that was interesting from the studies of the Oklo reactors that Kuroda had predicted, they not only functioned as thermal neutron reactors, they also functioned to some extent as fast neutron breeder reactors. And so this was sort of a way of having some justification for saying that there must be breeder reactors at the centers of these planets.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I got involved with a chap at Oak Ridge, and he made a couple of modifications to some programs that have been developed over the past 30 years that are used for simulating the operation of different types of nuclear reactors. And found out, yes, a reactor could function over the entire life of the planet Earth, 4.5 billion years, and it would function as a fast breeder reactor. And so it did all the things that I had predicted and had necessarily assumed, because I couldn't predict some of the things.
Now I'm going to interrupt for a second.
Sure.
Going back to your initial, when I asked you what the kind of concentration the uranium has, you mentioned it was fairly low concentration, but is the uranium itself in seams, or so that, you know, the uranium comes together, or is it distributed through the other materials?
Oh, okay. This is an important question. In the meteorites, the uranium tends to be concentrated in a few of the minerals, but even its concentration there is very low. What I thought is the basis for concentration in planets is the following. At the pressures that prevail inside of planets, density is a function almost entirely of atomic number and atomic mass.
Okay.
Not crystal structure. And so the most dense substance would be uranium. And so that would be the ultimate driving force that would concentrate it, perhaps by a series of steps.
Okay.
And it would end up concentrated at the center of the Earth, because it is the most dense material.
And the lighter materials would be towards the outer parts of this inner core, right?
Yes, and here's another interesting thing. You know, when you are on the right track in science, things fall into place naturally.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, you have to keep making excuses for things. I mean, no, it's like movies. I know if you go to the movies, you've seen some bad movies.
I've seen some bad movies, yes.
And they're movies that are like scenes that are stuck together. They're disconnected. They're just stuck together.
Right. There's no coherent story there.
But if you see a really good movie, you'll see that all of the scenes are related logically. They're related causally in time, and it just flows. Well, nature is like that. And so if you're really on the right track of making a discovery, you don't find impediments that you have to make excuses for. And I found this out quite strikingly when I first started considering planetary scale nuclear reactors. Because the first thing that when I mentioned it to someone, And his first response was, well, that's fine. You'd have a reactor for a while, but the fission products would build up, and then it would shut the reactor down.
But well, not if the fission products are less dense.
That's true. And see, well, that's exactly right. At the interior of the Earth, The fission products are roughly half the mass and half the atomic number, so they will be less dense. So their tendency will be to migrate outward, while the tendency of the uranium is to migrate inwardly, downward.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a natural tendency to separate the fission products from the uranium fuel, even though there may be very low gravitational acceleration in the region.
Yeah.
It's certainly not zero, but we're talking a region of microgravity.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also talking very high temperatures, too. So.
And pretty large differences in density. If the density is just based on atomic mass, obviously fission products are about half or less or a little bit more than uranium.
Right. In a paper I published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London in 1994, the editor wanted me to calculate the difference in the density as a function of the mass of the fission products. And so I actually have a figure in there where I calculated that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a big difference. So you see, these things just sort of happen naturally. And I rather suspect that that the whole concept I want to say planetocentric nuclear reactors is a far more general natural phenomenon than people in the geosciences or planetary sciences have ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the planet Mercury has a magnetic field. And there's good reason to think, although I'm not sure it's yet been totally proven beyond the shadow of doubt, that field is being currently generated.
Mm-hmm.
Mercury is a very small planet with a big core and should be more or less solid. And so where is this energy coming from? And it becomes much more of an interesting problem.
Well, here's another phenomenon I want to... The magnetic field in the Earth has been known to shift and change directions.
Yes.
How is your georeactor theory supportive of that? I mean, because as you say, things start to fall into place when the explanation is really true.
Oh, I'll tell you a couple of things. There was a paper published in by K.R. Rao in Current Science in, I think it was 2002. And the title of it was something like, and I'm not quoting this precisely, but a nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth, the solution to magnetic field variability and helium in oceanic basalts.
Okay.
Something like that. So let me explain. All of the energy sources previously envisioned for powering the geomagnetic field, whether real or imagined,
mm-hmm.
all would only change gradually and only in one direction through time. Like radioactive decay energy. I mean, you know, you'd be slowly diminishing.
Right. Very predictable and...
And very irreversible.
Right. Always in this, always going down.
A nuclear reactor, on the other hand, can increase power, decrease power. It can start. It can stop. It can restart.
Mm-hmm.
So that's offers a different explanation for the possible variability one sees with the geomagnetic field. I mean, before, when people were only thinking about energy sources that were slowly varying in one direction, they had to assume that the changes in the geomagnetic field were mechanical changes,
mm-hmm.
like something in the dynamo just flipped or
right.
something. And what I've offered the possibility that it might be something entirely different.
That's one of those excuses that you talked about for theories that aren't really holding together.
Exactly. And the geoscience literature is full of such things. And the other thing is that when I originally did the calculations, I used Fermi's nuclear reactor theory, like Kuroda did, which allowed me to predict absolutely no fission products. But when I got involved with this chap, Dan Hollenbach, at Oak Ridge, and we made the first calculations using the codes that had been developed over 30 years, they yielded fission products. And the exciting part, and it's something that I thought might be the case, but I was, you know, it was like something that I saw as a possibility, but one of those things that I would not hold my breath or bet my life or maybe not even bet a day's wages on. But as the first results came in, they were right on target. And this is the story. In the late 1960s, oceanographers discovered helium in oceanic basalt, the lava that's extruded from beneath the floor of the ocean, has traces of helium in it. And it's helium of mass 3 and helium of mass 4. Now, what made this so remarkable is that the helium 3-4 ratio is higher than it is in air. In that it's higher in the basalt than it is in air, which means it's not contaminated with air. So the big question is, where did that helium come from? Well, helium 4, everyone knows that's an alpha particle that scoops up some electrons.
Right.
You know, no problem finding helium 4. But no one at the time knew of a deep Earth source for helium 3, that and so it was assumed that that was primordial helium 3. It was helium 3 that was trapped at the time the Earth formed, and then diluted with helium 4 to give the proportion that was found in the helium basalts, in the oceanic basalts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we got the first fission product results, it turned out that the helium 3-4 ratio produced by the georeactor, the numerical simulation, was precisely in the range of values that's observed in oceanic basalts. And later, with even more refined calculations, it turns out that the georeactor is capable of producing the entire range of ratios that's observed, and would produce enough helium to, if you make some reasonable explanations or assumptions that this helium is coming out in the same amount over the lifetime of the Earth, your reactor would produce enough to account for that. And so this was a big step forward, because it explained not only the potential variability of the Earth's magnetic field, but it also explained, without any assumptions, the helium that's coming out. In fact, if you go look at it the other way, the helium that's coming out is, in fact, evidence for the existence of the georeactor.
Interesting.
So this is good. Now, if I could go one step beyond what all this means in even a broader context.
Okay.
And I'll tell you about another mistake that people made. Back in the at the turn of the century, the beginning of the 20th century, one of the greatest unknowns was, what is the energy source that powers the sun and other stars? And at first, scientists thought, well, you know, when the dust and gas collapse, they coalesce, all that gravitational potential energy will be converted into kinetic energy. You'll have heat, and that's what's fueling the sun. Well, it didn't take long before somebody did some calculations and found out that, well, that would maybe work for a couple million years, but certainly not as long as life has existed on Earth. Well, the timing was great, because about this time radioactivity was discovered. And I'm not sure the exact day, I think it was 1923, thermonuclear fusion reactions were discovered. And immediately people started working on these. People such as von Weizsacker, Edward Teller, Hans Bethe. In fact, Hans Bethe won the 1967 Nobel Prize for his work on the thermonuclear reactions that are thought to power the sun. Well, I imagine many people in your audience know that thermonuclear gets its name thermo because high temperatures are required,
right?
Temperatures on the order of a million degrees. Well, when thermonuclear reactions were first considered for powering the sun and for other stars, well, it was obvious. Well, when a dust and gas coalesce, they produce heat at the surface, and that heat gets to be a million degrees. It lights off the thermonuclear reactions, and there you got stars lighted everywhere you go.
Mm-hmm.
And so all this was pretty well worked out by the nature of the reactions by 1938. The discovery of nuclear fission was published early in 1939. So all this was before fission. And it was, people often just, when they do something in science, they just keep moving forward. And that's what astrophysicists did. And in the 1960s, when computers first became readily available,
mm-hmm.
Astrophysicists started making more detailed calculations. And they started realizing that there was a problem. You couldn't get temperatures of a million degrees. And the reason is this. You heat from the surface.
Okay.
But that heating from the surface is offset by radiation from the surface.
Right.
Radiation from the surface is a function of the fourth power of temperature.
The hotter you get, the more you radiate, and by a large amount.
Yeah, so when you get to a million degrees, you're talking about a factor that has in it a million times a million times a million times a million.
That's a lot of radiated heat.
That's a lot of radiated heat. So people who make models of star formation, well, they try to tweak the parameters. Well, if we form a star real fast or have a real opaque medium so you don't radiate all that stuff. And no one stopped to think, well, maybe there's a problem. Maybe that's not right. Well, in that paper in that I published in 1994 in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London, I suggested that stars, like hydrogen bombs, are ignited by nuclear fission. You know, there's a real parallel between the thermonuclear reactions in stars and in hydrogen bombs.
Oh, sure.
Each hydrogen bomb has its own nuclear fission device to get that million or so degrees to ignite the reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suggested this for stars.
I bet that went over well.
Pardon?
I bet that went over well.
Oh, did it ever. Did it ever. It's a real tribute to the editor at the time, because I got such biting reviews that the editor decided, I actually had two papers pending at the time, and the editor decided that the only way to handle this was to sit down and for he himself to go through each with a fine-tooth comb, and he combined them into one and asked me to do a few additional calculations that he wanted.
Okay.
And it got published. Well, there. Of course, the astrophysics community ignored that. But now it's coming to be something of some great importance, I think, because one of the things that I mentioned in that paper was the possibility of non-ignition. In other words, if you have stars that don't have the heavy elements, the uranium,
mm-hmm.
You'll end up with dark stars. And I've suggested that is the explanation for dark matter. And there may be some other interesting implications. Only recently people have been, you know, imaging stars that have their own planetary system, stars other than the sun. and they found some interesting results. And one of the interesting results is that they found a Jupiter-like star, Jupiter-like planets that are very close to the sun, to the star. That's one thing. They also have found what they refer to as hot Jupiters, Jupiters with densities of about, Jupiter-like planets that have densities of about half what Jupiter has. And what that means is that there's some sort of an energy source producing heat to expand those gases to make that planet less dense. And the astrophysicists haven't found a solution that is generally applicable to all of the hot Jupiters. And in fact, one set of authors has said that the astrophysics community has overlooked something. And I have a paper out. It's posted on ARXIV. And I'm engaged in a major battle with astrophysics journal letters, mm-hmm. because they're trying to suppress it. That's basically the idea that you have with these a central region that's driven by nuclear fission. And at the interface, you have nuclear fusion reactions. Now, in a star, you have enough mass that the gaseous shell can contain the fusion reactions, can hold the pressure. But with a planet, you can't. So you can only have, you know, like a surficial reaction at the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the subject of that short paper. But the astrophysics community doesn't like it because it might cause them to admit that stars, like hydrogen bombs, are ignited by nuclear fission.
Now, let's think about this for a little bit. Other than the fact that you're challenging long-held beliefs, have you come up with any other theories as to why the astrophysics community is so adamantly opposed to accepting your ideas?
Well, I found the same problem with the geophysics community. With respect to what began with the inner core,
mm-hmm.
I've had reviewers of papers say that I'm throwing out 40 years of geophysics. Well, I've had reviewers saying the same thing, that I'm throwing out 40 years of astrophysics. Now, I don't know what it is. I honestly don't. I was talking with a friend about this today. You see, science is about finding out how the world, how the Earth, how the universe really is.
Right.
It's not promulgating a particular belief system. I mean, that's what's done in churches.
Right.
That's what's done in religious organizations or political organizations. It's about finding out how nature really is. And if you're going down the path of discovery and you make a mistake, like people did with the inner core of the Earth, or, and I think, like they did with the stellar ignition, they get trapped at a plateau where they can't move forward, because you move forward in science logically one step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're on the wrong track, then you get trapped, and all you can start doing is pasting pieces together like the scenes of a bad movie.
Well, see, that's the difference between a scientist and an engineer. an engineer, maybe as inspired by someone like Thomas Edison, would welcome some mistakes because they figure out ways that just don't work.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a difference between a scientist and an engineer. I would say that a good scientist and a good engineer agree on that.
Okay.
All right? I'm saying that there are a lot of scientists who need to be good scientists. And they need to realize that this is the strange part. This is really the strangest part. Why suppress new ideas? When new ideas often beget other new ideas, and new ideas may open new pathways of thinking, and new ideas may correct incorrect pathways of thinking. And all of those things open doors for greater discovery. And so people sometimes wonder when they look at the things that I've done over a lifetime. I've had a lot of important insights. And how can that be? Well, the reason is because I've gone step by step logically, and I've kept a totally open mind to what is beyond. And people that don't do that, they get trapped, and so they can't move forward. So you'd think that people would want to and would welcome new ideas and controversy and so forth. Why they don't is a great mystery to me.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. I'll interrupt here for a second. You mentioned way back in the early part of this interview that your support had dried up and you were out of a job.
Yes.
Excuse me, I think that Shane may have just showed up.
Pardon?
I said I think that Shane may have showed up. No, never mind. Okay, that was a little Skype Boeing. Boeing came in, so I thought it was I thought it was my partner Shane. But anyway, you mentioned that your support had dried up, and obviously you kept working in the field, at least doing publishing and stuff. What happened later?
Well, my support totally dried up, and I did consulting work. I did a whole bunch of things, including developing technology that was related to mining and taking over mining operations that were in trouble. And I was in the antique business for a while, but I did the science on my own at much reduced efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes I think, my gosh, suppose I had a job just doing that. Now, when I first got the idea of the planetocentric nuclear reactors and that paper was published, I spent a month writing a proposal to NASA's Planetary Geophysics Program.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Kuroda agreed to be a co-investigator, although he said that he didn't need the money. He'd do it pro bono. Well, that proposal, I learned, was ranked number 120 of 120 new proposals considered relevant to their program. Of course, the people that were doing the ranking were also supported by that program with a high concentration at JPL. So the federal support for my work has not been forthcoming. So I've just sort of had to make do on my own.
Well, I think maybe that is one of the reasons why you've been able to follow where the science leads you rather than trying to figure out how to protect your funding source.
Exactly. That's really the truth, because what's happened is that circumstances have evolved in such a way that people who get funding can't. They can't be honest and challenge the consensus mentality. They can't do that and keep their funding. So I have had a huge degree of independence, and at some considerable price, I might add. But the results have been very good, because I've begun to make discoveries that are appreciated worldwide, and that says a lot, since I'm just one guy and I don't have a press department or, you know, all the fleet of graduate students working for me or things like that. I've been able to make some progress.
Well, you know, I think you chose a particularly challenging field in which to publish research about nuclear fission, because from my investigations, the geophysics community doesn't like nuclear fission very much.
They don't. They don't like anything new.
I'm going to be a little bit more cynical about that. The vast majority of support for the geophysics community comes from one particular industry.
When you say industry, well, what are you talking about?
Well, what do we get out of the geophysics research that most people do, and that's, we find new sources of fossil fuels.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. But, you know, so little geophysics, most of the money, though, comes from the government. Most of the research funds come from the government. And there you have the problem of you don't cross the line with the consensus.
Mm-hmm.
But now this is that there are going to be things that are will astound you of what the geophysics community is going to have to find itself facing. I have a website. Well, I have one website is nuclearplanet.com,
mm-hmm.
which I think you know about.
Right.
My other website is understandearth.com. And over the past year or so, I've gone way beyond the geophysics community with respect to the circumstances under which the Earth formed and the geodynamics of the Earth as a whole. And I know you know about plate tectonics theory.
Right.
Do you know about Earth expansion theory? Not to put you on the spot, this goes back to the early 1930s. These were sort of competing theories that were always two things that each had their advocates. The Earth expansion had fewer because there were some real problems. What kind of an energy source could expand the Earth? Well, what I've done is I've unified those two theories into one called whole Earth decompression dynamics. And it gets back to the Earth's formation as not from little bits of dust that gather up and become bigger and bigger grains and pebbles like the old story, because that would end up giving us terrestrial planets that have insufficiently massive cores.
Mm-hmm.
But rather from planets literally raining out from inside of giant gaseous protoplanets and then collapsing on themselves, so that you have Earth in its prior days was a Jupiter-like planet, almost identical in mass to Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
If you put the Earth back with all of its primordial gases. And that's enough to compress the continental crust of the Earth to be a closed shell.
Mm-hmm.
So when the sun ignited, thermonuclear reactions, very violent ignition initially, literally stripped the atmospheres from the planets of the inner solar system. And the Earth would then begin to decompress.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing manifest at the surface is the consequence of whole Earth decompression. This is all on my website. It's a long story to tell.
Yeah.
All of the pieces are there, and there's and it's all falls into place quite logically, and it's consistent with what people see in these other planetary systems, where they see close-to-star gas giants.
Wow. Well, Dr., my friend Shane has joined us.
Good evening, Dr. Herndon. How are you?
Oh, hi, Shane. How are you?
I came in just as the tail end of your description of, I believe it was chondritic formation of planets and some alternatives thereof.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've covered a whole lot of stuff here. And main thing I wanted to do was to focus people's attention on a website, which is understandearth.com, because it describes all of the underlying science, and there are a lot of the papers that can be downloaded, the scientific papers, and there's some sort of animated graphics. They're not very good. I did them myself. But they get some of the picture across, and it's going to be a different world to look at if you want to think about science and think about how the world really is. It offers some interesting possibilities. One thing, for example, I published a paper in Current Science, which is the Indian equivalent of Science and Nature, published in association with the Indian Academy of Science, on the enhanced prognosis for abiotic petroleum and natural gas.
That's Thomas Gold's theory of Cornell, isn't it?
Well, actually, it's a Russian theory that Thomas Gold helped to promote. But it was first done by the Russians. You're right. Tommy Gold published a book called Deep Hot Biosphere. I read that book trying to, with the thought in mind that I was going to try to find something wrong with the ideas. I couldn't find anything that I could say is wrong. So I mean, it's something that's worthy of looking at. But there's a section on that website. So I mean, these are times to be able to look at different things in our planet and get a fresh outlook and a fresh approach.
Well, one of the great things about today is that people like you, who have these thoughts, don't have to be suppressed or have to wait for somebody else to give approval to publish your work.
Oh, I'm telling you, the internet is a blessing. I mean, for years and years, my work was suppressed. Every once in a while, I would get a paper published. But even so, when somebody, for example, in the news media ran across it, they'd pick up the phone, call their local geophysicist. Their geophysicist friend would say negative things, and no one would ever hear about it. The first real break I got was in the 2002 issue, the August issue of Discover Magazine, when my work was the cover story, the feature article. And that got it out to people all over.
Mm-hmm.
And people, ordinary people, scientists, engineers, fry cooks at fast food, people, all kinds of people wanted to learn about it. And what they wanted to hear was, what are the arguments? They wanted to get a sense of, you know, how the world really is. And this has opened a great door. And the internet will change in a fundamental way, the way people get to the truth out. Because, you know, you can't deceive people when they are exposed to ready access to information. Pretty soon the charlatans become evident, and the serious people, they also become evident.
Yeah. Well, and there's plenty of serious people who continue to publish things that don't really make a lot of sense in academic journals. They're serious about it, though.
Oh, I know. I realize that. But you know, they publish so much in the academic journals that nobody reads them.
Oh, I know. They're just a way to list your CV.
Well, there's also something else that's been done, and this is largely done to satisfy the needs of the contracts and grants that people get. They make models. They make models based upon assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody can do that. And the model doesn't have to be right.
Well, if the assumptions are wrong, it never will be right. But
right. And, well, George Box, who was a statistician, said it really quite succinctly. All models are wrong. A few are useful. Well, I don't make models, and because you can't build upon assumptions. You have to build logically on what is true. And if you begin at the foundation of knowledge and progress from there, then you've got yourself a good, strong foundation. And as long as you don't make a mistake, your doors will just fall open before you.
Boy, you're really challenging the income of a few people who make their living by producing deliverables for the U.S. government.
Well, you know, it's sad that people have to do that. It would be much better, I think. I think what the geophysical lab in Washington used to have a really nice procedure. They've changed all that now when they started getting government support. They publish a yearbook once a year, and a scientist would write a very short very short paper about what he had done during the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe every 5 years, a longer paper. And that's all that people really need to do, because you can't make, well, most people can't make 4 or 5 brand new exciting discoveries every year. I mean, that's, you know.
No, but they could write 4 or 5 almost identical papers every year.
Yeah, that's about the size of it, too.
Especially when you can cut and paste.
Yeah.
I've lost track of the number of engineering research articles where I've seen the same sentences being used to start off the abstracts and introductory text.
Oh, yes. Well,
I won't name names, but it's a pretty well-known phenomenon in engineering, physics, and research, as well as in science.
Well, with Google, you can do all kinds of magical things. I've heard about one school teacher, English teacher, who would Google phrases in students' papers and find the original source that they were plagiarized from. Well, listen, guys, I've got some commitment.
Okay.
So I think we need to sort of draw.
We can draw it to. I was just getting ready to do that. I just wanted to last a little bit long enough so that Shane could ask you a couple questions. But I think that we've had a great conversation, and I really appreciate your time, Doctor.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it, and the one thing that I that is very near and dear to my heart is the science that I do. You know, I don't get supported to do the science. And I do science because it's what you do for people. And so having the opportunity to share this as I am is a real plus, because that's what it's all about. So I thank you for the opportunity as well.
Well, you have a nice evening, sir.
Thank you.
Good night.
What do Red Bull, yogurt, energy systems, and pole dancing have in common? They are all podcast topics on the Health and Fitness Show. Hi, I'm Betty from The Health and Fitness Show. If you want to know facts about health and fitness, then listen up. Visit health.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. Ooh, there's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.